and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering opening the show was Song of the Siren by Morgan Baum from her CD Sacred Hands. You can find more of her music at sacredhands.org. Well, and as you probably can hear, I think, I'm a bit under the weather tonight, so forgive my voice. I guess I had just too much fun at the season opening of Haramankna, the American Indian Cultural Center here in Los Angeles, which I attended over the weekend. I actually wrote an article about it that includes a slideshow of pictures if you'd like to check out my Examiner column. Well, if you've never heard of Haramankna, it would make a good day trip from the Los Angeles area. It's located at the Angeles Crest Highway and Mount Wilson Red Box Road. And actually, the drive up there to Haramankna Cultural Center through the valleys and mountains, among the low-hanging clouds, well, you know, that drive, it's your first gift to yourself, you know, allowing you to cast off the stress of the city as you start to reconnect with Gaia and the magic of the high places. Many today see Haramankna as a sacred place, nestled in the arms of Mother Mountain, known by some for its sacred waters, which you can collect there, even drink. And this weekend, I experienced the magic of Haramankna for myself for the first time, as it opened its doors to the public for the first time since the fires of last year. As one traveled higher and higher, remnants of the fire were still evident, but one had to marvel at Mother Nature's ability to bounce back and work her restorative magic. Green was sprouting across the mountains and valley below, even from burned areas. Small waterfalls were cascading over the road, and driving through the clouds gave one the sense of being transported almost to otherworldly realms. And for goddess advocates, extra incentive to visit might be the fact that the Chumash Indians, those people were a matriarchal society, meaning their lineage was traced from the mother's side of the family, and the chief could either be a man or a woman. And, you know, once I got there, I was quickly immersed in the excitement of the day's activities. I was asked to be one of the judges in a wonderful art show highlighting American Indian artists. Then it was on to learning sacred songs, enjoying ethereal flute music, elder storytelling, and watching demonstrations using the mortar and pestle and other implements for work and play of the indigenous people. And did I mention the small museum with priceless artifacts? Well, yes, seeing the displays and the photographs really helps one get a clearer picture of the life of the early tribes of the area. And, you know, if your family goes up there and brings a brown bag lunch, there's a picnic area where the family can just sit and relax, soak in the sun, the clouds, the music, the rejuvenating energy up there at Haramankna. So anyway, check it out. Might be a really fun thing to do with the family. You can just plug in, recharge your batteries. It's only about 90 minutes from the west side, and you can take the family there to indulge in a little bit of culture, fun activities for the kids, and, you know, get your fix if you need to feel closer to nature. And you know, maybe where you live, it's hard for you to do that. Well, as I promised that I would do until Keith Olbermann is back on the air, in honor of him, we're going to actually ask the question that he would have been asking every night if he were still on Countdown on MSNBC. So here's the question. Mr. Boehner, Republicans, where are the jobs? We thought you were so concerned, or so you told the voters, but all you seem to be working on are cultural issues, trying to take rights away from women. All your party seems to be doing is trying to take rights away from workers. What's next? Well, you know, people are waking up to your budget battle being about culture war and not really about fixing the budget, because if you were interested in fixing the budget, you wouldn't have held unemployment benefits hostage to get tax cuts for the rich, and you would be looking at cutting the war budget and discontinuing the subsidies to corporate welfare queens. And Mr. Boehner, in Wisconsin, the people are starting to take back their state. Maybe it won't be long before we take back our country, and not the country of the phony populist Tea Party funded by the Koch brothers and company. So that's my political comment for the week. And a bit of housekeeping before we get to tonight's first guest, Charlene Spretnak. I wanted to tell you that next Friday, the 15th of April, I'm going to be giving a talk at the Theosophical Society in America in Long Beach. It's a free talk, and the topic is going to be the practical values of the sacred feminine, practical values of the sacred feminine. So you can actually look up the Theosophical Society in America on the Internet and just go to the Long Beach location, which is actually in Seal Beach, and you can find out the address, or you can always just email me, and I'm happy to give you all the details. Also, please remember, or maybe it's the first time you've heard, Blog Talk is no longer free to hosts like myself. Last year was great because Blog Talk provided us this platform free of charge, and we could in turn pass it along to the wonderful people we interview every week. But now that's going to cost us. And while it's not a whole lot, it's still not free. It costs us at least about $30 to $40 each month, so we're looking for a sponsor, or even a few people who might just commit to helping us pay for the show now and then to keep it on the air. So if you believe like we do, like Goddess teaches us, what you tend to nurture and nourish, it thrives, and what you neglect withers, I'd just like to encourage you to maybe send in a contribution. And you can do that by going to my website, KarenTate.com. Go to the Goddess Store page, and you'll see PayPal buttons there, and you can make a donation of any amount you can afford. And please remember the three F's. You find these on my show page. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Also, become our friend. And maybe most important, click the follow button so that you never miss notice of my new guests each week. And that way, you're a part of our growing family of listeners. Also, I want to make sure you know about the tour I'm leading to Turkey for men and women in November. To Turkey, or Anatolia as it was once called, Land of the Nourishing Mothers. That's going to happen in November, and we're going to be going to all the places you'd expect. Side, Lagina, which was the site of the only standing temple to Hecate that modern man has uncovered yet. Of course, Istanbul, Ephesus, Chateau Hayuk. You know, Turkey is really a diamond in the rough, and a lot of the places we go, other tourists don't go. So it enables us to really have private time at the rituals, and private time at the sites so we can do rituals. Also, we're going to do things like Turkish baths, and there's these wonderful mineral waters very near the sacred site of Aphrodite called Aphrodisias. So anyway, we're only going to take 20 people. If this sounds like something you might be interested in, if you're feeling called to take part in a spiritual journey, again, go to my website, KarenTate.com. Well, let's turn our attention to tonight's show. Many of you have emailed me saying how much you like when I open the show, our first guest this way. So because you've asked for it, I'll repeat it. And this is it. As many of you know, adversaries of the sacred feminine tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy or selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, women in their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, disrespected. That's why here on the show, I'm dedicated to recovering the great she, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal. Yes, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women, to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so we know why things are the way they are today, how they have come to be turned so on their head and so unnatural. And we hope to go about setting things right, setting things more in balance. Why? Because if we want to save ourselves as a species, well, I think we might not have no other choice. So let me once again repeat what have become the two mottos for the show. The first comes from the 19th century German philosopher, author Schopenhauer. It goes like this. All truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. And the second one is from Gandhi. He said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Okay, so let's not delay any further because we have a lot to get to, and I'd like to welcome my first guest, Charlene Spretnak. I'm sure you've heard her name before. Let me read her bio for you. Let's see. Charlene is the author of several books on ecological and relational thought, cultural history, spirituality, feminism, and contemporary events. These include Green Politics, The Global Promise, The Spiritual Dimension of Green Politics, States of Grace, The Recovery of Meaning in the Postmodern Age, The Resurgence of the Real, Body, Nature, and Place in a Hyper-Modern World, Missing Mary. She's also the editor of an anthology that's been in print since 1982, The Politics of Women's Spirituality. In 2006, she was named by the Environmental Department of the British government one of the 100 eco-heroes of all time. She resides in Ojai, California, and further information can be found at her website, which is her name, CharleneSpretnak.com. Well, Charlene, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And tell me, did I get those book titles right? Because the spacing of the email was a little odd.
No, it sounded fine.
Okay, good. I didn't want to say any of your book titles wrong. Well, tonight we actually sort of shifted gears a little bit and decided to have our show topic about your new book that's going to be out soon. And the title is Relational Reality, subtitled New Discoveries of Interrelatedness That Are Transforming the Modern World. So do you find, Charlene, that some people don't always know what you mean by relational reality? And for my listeners who don't know, could you maybe explain that?
Sure. It's a phenomenon that has different labels over time. I suppose in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, it might have been called the holistic perception of reality. But I prefer relational reality because this is about the interrelatedness of everything in existence. And it's very hard for us to really wrap our minds around the fact that relationships are not something we could be in or not be in, something we could have or not have. Instead, we're composed of relationships. We're completely made of relationships, relationships internally within the body-mind, relationships with our surrounding ecological context, very subtle relationships with other people, and we have very little awareness of that. In fact, I really think our hyper-modern society is currently just at a kindergarten level of understanding the deeply interrelated nature of reality. So this book is about the fact that although this has been perception has been growing slowly around the margins of society for a few decades. I was surprised around 2004 to start noticing discoveries that would be written up in little articles in the paper, say about the way our body works, some physiological discovery, and they were all about interrelatedness that the researchers had not expected to find at all. And there were more and more of these, so I started clipping them out, and I realized that things were picking up speed and that the relational reality was really moving into the mainstream in every area, finally, and transforming it.
So you're talking about beyond the idea where I think maybe most people automatically go to, well, we've lost our connection with nature, but you're saying it's much, much bigger than this.
Yeah, it's also our own nature. For instance, These discoveries in recent years that, the Scandinavian study I'm thinking of now about dementia, what protects one from developing dementia in old age? Well, over here, we're always told it's mental calisthenics, like doing crossword puzzles. You need to keep exercising those brain muscles and doing these crossword puzzles. But they found in this study in Sweden that it's whether you have a few great good relationships around you. That's the biggest protecting factor to predict who's going to get dementia or not.
Wow.
And Another one they found, this is just a few years ago, was that mental performance, including memory, is improved if you have some social interaction with someone 10 minutes before the test, even talking on the phone to a person or talking in person to somebody.
Even if it's not related to what
the test No,
is.
They're going to give you some memory test, and you don't know what's on that. But
Right. Just,
you know, it's almost like blinders are coming off. Like we're beginning to know our true nature after being in this mechanistic view of reality for 300 years of modernity, and suddenly now we're saying, oh, it's not like that. It's so dynamic and interrelated and creative. And, you know, we are literally becoming, every moment to moment, becoming. So it's much more interesting than we thought.
Well, you know, interestingly, if I could interject this, just this morning, and I didn't connect it until right now, there was something on the news. They were talking about the people who have lived very long lives, you know, into their 90s, into their hundreds, in places like Japan, and I forgot where the other place was. But what did they think the reason was? Wasn't just, you know, maybe they had a better diet. It was because their social structures, and I'm thinking, well, that means their relationships with other people, their connection, their interconnection, you know, maybe have led to their longer lives.
Yeah, that's definitely what this recent research would point to. In fact, that's been growing for quite a while. The first classic study was done in the late 70s in Alameda County. And as one of the researchers said, we found it didn't matter what people were eating. They could be drinking whiskey every day and having very greasy hamburgers. But if they were embedded in a network of social relationships, those people lived throughout this 15-year study. And the people who were not well situated in a relational network were the ones who died during the course of the study. And that's been replicated cross-culturally.
Well, yeah, you know, sometimes you'll hear on television, you know, they'll ask some old guy, you know, what does he account his longevity to, you know, and the interviewer thinks he's going to say, you know, because he's been taking really good care of himself, and he says he's been living on bourbon and cigarettes.
Yeah, I love those. Also, I like that one answer someone gave, you know, what's the secret to old age? And he said, oh, good health and a bad memory. Because you forget all the grudges, you know. You don't want to be weighed down with those.
Right. Well. Are there other examples of in health
this
or
is
healthcare?
Filled with just scores and scores of these recent examples. And I myself, even though I'd been tracking this phenomenon for a few decades, was amazed at what has been discovered in recent years. Here's another one. Okay, IQ. Now, that is something that in the mechanistic understanding of the body, it's a given. It's part of our, you know, physical set that we're born with. And even though setting aside the fact that there are, of course, cultural biases in IQ tests, it's not that they're that perfect at all, but even still, they discovered more than 15 years ago, that they could see a correlation between birth order and IQ, and they didn't know why that was. So the eldest child in a family would often score about 3 points more on the standardized IQ tests in school. But this really interesting study a few years ago of the Dutch Army gave all these 19-year-old boys an IQ test, and then they started looking at the family histories for 241,000 of them over so many years. And they found that correlation with the eldest child scoring about 3 points more on the IQ test. But what they found that they didn't expect was if the firstborn child died and the secondborn child became the eldest through those years of being raised up to 19, then he scored the extra 3 points usually associated with the eldest. And if the first two children died and the third one in the birth order became the eldest in the family dynamics, then he scored that extra 3 IQ points that the eldest are known to score. So that is really interesting because it means IQ is partly a relational phenomenon. the
so
research
do they know why the
they
oldest?
They didn't guess, they didn't surmise, they didn't put out any theories as to why. It might be because I think sometimes parents give the eldest child responsibility, look after the other children, and that might make them feel more adult-like and confident. Or maybe it's because the eldest child tends to identify with the adult world a little more, including
mm-hmm.
things like testing, so they might be a little more confident. But it's very interesting because, you know, before this test, no physiologist would say your IQ is going to change depending on whether, you know, the people in front of you die and you're raised as the eldest or not. I mean, that would have been unheard of.
Well, and you almost wonder, and of course this is anecdotal, but, you know, the first child probably is fawned over and showered with more attention, and then, well, if he dies, well, then maybe that gets transferred to the second child. Maybe it's just the nurturing, you know, the attention. I don't know, you're making me wonder, you know, when you were talking about dementia, you know, like when old folks now end up sort of getting warehoused in old folks' homes and they're sort of abandoned by their family,
right.
You know, makes you wonder if that can lead to dementia, you know, that disconnect from the
yeah.
people who are supposed to love them, you know?
Right, right. Well, it's very interesting because there's a new relational therapy for Alzheimer's that was developed at a nursing home in Phoenix called the Beatitudes. And they have everybody either off drugs completely or down to a very low level, and they don't use any restraints, which is unusual for an Alzheimer's nursing home, and they have no what's called sundowning, which means Alzheimer's patients start, their minds get agitated when the
mm-hmm.
natural light starts going at dusk.
Mm-hmm.
And the main thing in this relational therapy, well, for one thing, it respects their wishes. They can basically do pretty much what they want in that they can eat anytime. If they don't have appetite at mealtimes, there's always food set out in the dining room. If they have a favorite thing, if it's a shot of whiskey every day, they can have it. If it's a piece of chocolate every day, they can have it. And then in the therapies, they don't do group therapies. They do one-to-one therapy where the therapist tries to find out some activity, what activities in their past decades really made them happy, and then gives them some object or reminder that brings up the relationship of the way it felt to be in that happy activity. And that has such a curative effect. It's quite amazing, as
wow.
I say, to get rid of the drugs and get rid of the restraints. And so they've trained a lot of people to do that therapy in other states. Anyway, there's one more back on IQ, and that's that a study in 2009 found that IQ scores correlate with whether a child was spanked and how often. The more spanking, the more damage to the IQ. And that was tested cross-culturally. So again, just a few years ago, you'd be, you know, laughed out of a physiologist's office if you said that. He said, no, you know, IQ is what you're born with. That's not going to change. But that's obviously not true. I mean, striking a child is such a violation of the body-mind that it just throws off the developmental process, obviously, from this study.
Wow. Well, you know, what I'm hearing you say would keep sort of hitting the front of, you know, front of my head, and I know this is oversimplifying it, but nurturing. You know, compassion, loving people, you know, paying attention to one another. You know, I guess, you know, there's more to it than maybe we really ever thought about, you know, and the lack of it. You know, when we think about the society that we live in and the ruthlessness of it, the cruelty of it, the predator nature of it
yeah.
these days.
Really?
You know, no wonder people are in the state that they're in.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, the connection, because I look at four large areas in this book to show how relational thinking is just changing all the assumptions. Really, there could be any number of areas. It's happening everywhere, but I picked four large ones just as examples, and one of them is education and parenting. And when you were talking about that, maybe it's, you know, this is really what's needing and what's missing, what's needed.
We'll talk more about that. How is it manifesting in education and parenting, besides what you've said about the spanking?
Well, there was a
study
of the public schools in Chicago a few years ago that found that the presence of relational trust among teachers, students, and administrators and parents was a far more significant indicator of academic success than the material indicators like money or class size. Although I myself am a strong advocate of small classes in the younger years. However, they found relational trust was really trumping all the rest. And I think we would all add relational warmth. If we had a memorable teacher in our early elementary years, it's probably because she was very wise and she developed, you know, a warm relationship with every student. So they felt held.
Right.
And then they found that there's a correlation between whether a student feels happy and how much they absorb, how much they learn. So they, a lot of schools have these what they call happiness habits that they try to get the kids in, like start the day thinking of something, someone in your life for whom you have a deep appreciation. And then during the day, a habit of thoughtfulness. The first one's a habit of gratitude. The second one's a habit of thoughtfulness. Do something for someone every day. And then habit of optimism. You know, curb this negative self-talk in your mind and just focus on possibility. So they have the children sort of just, you know, getting into that mindset as an automatic way to go through the day.
Well, I'm wondering, Charlene, you know, we're hearing so much about bullying in schools and, you know, violence in schools. Did you run across anything where maybe they tried these techniques in one of these, you know, really hardcore schools? And
It's not only the hardcore schools where they have the kind of acting out that ends up with a juvenile criminal record, but it is a harsh world now at every socioeconomic level for these kids. I start every chapter in relational reality with what I call a snapshot of the crises, because I don't feel we can solve these problems unless we're willing to look right at them. So what I found about what happens to kids today is just amazing. It's very, very different from when we were young. For one thing, just that electronic immersion at a very early age is disrupting the usual developmental patterns in the brain. But then when they get into school and everybody's so plugged in, they're texting all the time. A third of the students in the country, it was found last year, would rather text their close friends than talk to them. And they're very anxious. They're always checking to see if they've been trashed at some social media site, who's being trashed today, which way the winds are blowing. They're checking to see if their posting was received the way they want to make people think of them, whether they're being left out of something. So it's a very anxious, insecure world to be in, and the anonymity of some online sites, you know, make trashing and bullying just irresistible for some people because they don't have to put their name on it.
Right, right. Well, so really, you know, we're saying it's going beyond, you know, people sitting at their computers all day or lacking in social skills, you know, because they don't have to interact with people as much. You know, it's much, much worse than that.
And it's also psychologists call the culture of childhood has disappeared. And the culture of childhood meant the way we used to all run around by ourselves in the afternoon, you know, making the rules for our games and then working out what happens if somebody breaks the rules and, you know, what the rules are going to be, what they're not going to be, that kind of thing. So now they don't have that. And that if there's some argument that comes up on the playground, somebody just punches someone. So a lot of elementary schools have had to hire this new position who's called a recess coach just to keep the peace and try to get them to learn how to settle differences.
Wow.
They
That's
have a
incredible.
Very scheduled upbringing, and they don't have that free-form play among children that we used to have.
Wow.
So what they do successfully to counter this in the schools are, as I was saying, those happiness habits that you heard are essentially relational habits, you know, gratitude, thoughtfulness. And then they also have, in middle schools now, a lot of schools are teaching empathy workshops. And empathy took a nosedive in the studies after the year 2000 for adolescents and young adults, and no one's quite sure why. But
they're hearing Fox News as their parents listen to it.
Oh.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
Yeah, well, yes, definitely are getting meaner, that's for sure. So, yeah, the empathy workshops now they teach in middle school, and then this whole movement, resilience, to help children develop resilience in school, that's done really by having them cultivate the relational network around them, as well as, you know, seeing that they can overcome things that happen to them.
Well, Charlie, these new techniques and programs you're talking about, are we seeing those being implemented very much, or just in just sort of little isolated test
tube
places?
No, they're very much across the country. And that's in the younger grades. And then I talk about how different it is at the college level now, because the whole idea of studying things, you know, with a mechanistic worldview is just being pushed aside. And there are courses now everywhere, like they're called relational sociology, relational philosophy, relational ontology, relational ethics, relational history. I'm reading a list of them. I just Googled relational linguistics, relational geography, relational economics, you know, like that. It goes on and on. And I think the biggest example of the relational shift that's rippling through all the disciplines at the college level is in the field of psychology, which has gone out from training psychologists out into the field now. And the shift was that, of course, 20th century psychology was dominated by the Freudian model. So on the Freudian model, what's really important is that you separate from the mother, separate from the father, so that you can mature and, you know, come into your own individuality. But that started being challenged in the late 1970s by those women at Wellesley College at the Stone Center, Jean Baker Miller and others, and then Carol Gilligan's book. She was at Harvard then. So when those women started mounting what they call the relational-cultural model of the self, it was just mocked. That, oh, you women don't know how to do good science. You don't understand Freud. You can't even get it. But over time, their model has completely replaced the Freudian model in psychology. Students now are taught that Freudian psychology is a little box over on the side called classical psychoanalytical theory. And instead, they're really taught the relational model. For instance, which is sometimes called psychodynamic theory or attachment theory. What they learn is that mental health is primarily, not entirely, but a matter of how well you can rely on, relate to another person.
Hmm.
And it's not the getting away from relationships, but the being in them that is contributing to mental health. For instance, there was a study saying, what predicts who's going to have trouble and who's not when they go to the university? Now, on the Freudian model, the answer would have been, oh, I can tell you who will do well. It's who has separated really well from the mother and the father. But it was
right, exactly
the opposite. The ones who didn't have trouble were in very good family relationships and had their own network of social friends. And that's what correlated with the people who didn't have a collapse. So
well, you reminded me of a guest I had on the show I guess about a month ago, and he was talking about privilege in class and, you know, how men treat women and domestic violence and that kind of thing. And I asked him, I said, well, what do you recommend to mothers, you know, raising their sons so that they don't, you know, so that, that you know, they are gentler and, you know, more in touch with their feminine side and, you know, not sort of overcome with testosterone and violence. And he said, well, you know, they have to stay connected to their mother, you know, even though that's not always what society says needs to happen, and the child, you know, often maybe on the schoolyard is going to be teased for something like that. You know, the connection to the mother is really vital for the son's development.
That's right.
And, you know, so it you know, tying into what you're saying here too.
Yeah. And that reminds me, if I can move into the second area, which is health
sure.
and healthcare, our immune system. I'm sure we've all heard our doctors when we go for our annual physical say, they'll give the usual list of how to keep healthy. Say it's cold season. Well, remember, you know, get enough sleep, eat the right food, wash your hands during cold season. Oh, and have some friends and socialize with them. They sort of pack that on because of all these studies. It's like one of those, you know, children's puzzles. Which of these does not belong? And you're sort of wondering, you know, what did you say? Have friends? Doesn't that challenge everything else, you know, in the whole biomechanical model that you're schooled in? So it's not only that having friends, you know, helps our immune system, although that's been proven indisputably now. They did a study at Carnegie Mellon University where they asked volunteers if they could spray a cold virus into their noses, and then they correlated on a questionnaire who said they had a lot of friends and who said no, they didn't have many friends. The people with a lot of friends were 4 times less likely to get sick from the virus that had been put in their body.
Wow.
Now,
well, what about healing? Is there any evidence that people heal better? I know they say if you're prayed over.
I'll get into the healing, but there's a really interesting one about the immune system, which was a 35-year follow-up, 35 years after this study was done in the 50s at Harvard. It was called the Harvard Mastery of Stress Survey, and they asked the boys in the mid-50s a lot of questions like, you know, if they considered the parental caring they're getting. Is it loving? Is it just? Is it fair? Are your parents hardworking? And so one of the questions they were answered in that survey was, does your father love you enough? And another one was, does your mother love you enough? And then the daughter of one of the two people who conducted that survey, 35 years later, got a hold of the names and tracked down the addresses and sent them all a follow-up survey, and she was able to get, I think, about a third of the people. And here's what she found. Of those men at midlife who had rated both their parents high in parental caring, only 25% had developed a chronic midlife disease such as cardiovascular disease, ulcers, alcoholism, or others. But of those men who had rated both their parents low in parental caring and loving, 87% had developed a chronic disease by midlife.
Wow.
So
that's stunning.
Our immune system is formed in our childhood years through love.
Wow.
I mean, that is how relational we are at the physical level. And it's been completely missed in 300 years of modern medicine because it was on the biomechanical model.
Well, and you know, and you don't even hear about this in the news. You know, you've been, you know, but hearing all of this stuff about bullying and, you know, kids going into schools with guns and you know, the
right.
interviewer always says, well, what's going on? What, you know, how do we solve this? And I haven't heard one of them say what you're talking about.
Yeah,
I have a lot.
I can't go into it, but on this peer displacement problem that explains a lot of that behavior, it's too long a story here, but it my point in starting each of these four areas with a snapshot of the problems is so that people can start to see how many of our problems and crises are caused by anti-relational thinking or the lack of relational wisdom. And
so
then I go into all
it,
the solutions that are coming out of this relational perspective.
So, all right, well, let me just sort of broaden it a little bit and see if this is what you're saying. Okay, so up until now we're talking about a small-knit group around yourself. But by relational, can we also, you know, separate it out into left-wing, you know, conservative, liberal, red state, blue state? Is that does that fit into this too?
Well, I mean, the political ideology is more... You know, I say at one point, so people can understand what interrelatedness means, that it's not just that things are connected, like beads on a string are connected, but this is the profound constitutional interrelatedness. So the political ideology is more like beads on a string because, you know, the walls are just thrown up. And, I think that the... reactionary ideology is anti-relational. I think a lot of what's being done now is absolutely anti-relational. The only people they're in relationship with is the big corporate donors and very, very wealthy donors.
Well, that was my point. You know, does the fact that as human beings, you know, we divide, we have all of these wedge issues and we divide ourselves up into groups, and does that sort of hurt our immune system, you know, kind of a thing, you know, just the lack of harmony.
It probably does, but that reminds me of these two books, The Spirit Level and also The Fair Society, were written in the last couple of years. And they show all these detrimental occurrences in a society the more the income equality grows between the rich and the not rich. And then you see higher levels of high blood pressure, depression, all kinds of illnesses, all kinds of social breakdown. It's a very strong correlation.
Well, speaking of socioeconomic, I highlighted an article on my show once about the difference in how, poorer or moderate people relate to others versus how rich people relate to others. I think it was a study done at Berkeley, and it was talking about how since rich people just have to hire people, for them, they don't develop a relationship with people because all they got to do is use their money to get what they want, where poorer people or more moderate people, they depend on relationships. Maybe the neighbor's got to help, watch the kid
right.
while they go run to the drugstore, or they need a ride to work or something like that. So they actually develop better social skills than the people maybe who have more money.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, you said there were four categories. So we did health
there
and
were.
Healthcare.
There's a whole lot under health and healthcare. No, there's tons. I have inside of that, there's so much in that area that I have in three parts. There's one that's interrelationships between people, how that affects our health, and then all the relationships within the body-mind, and then with our body-mind and the natural world around us.
Well, we have 15 minutes. How do you think is the best way to spend the rest of the time?
I'll name them since you asked, and then I want to come to the implications for women since your audience here. I'm delighted to do that. But anyway, I'll just say that the other two after education and parenting and then health and healthcare are community design and architecture. For instance, under the mechanistic system, there's no difference in, say, three kinds of light that they might give you in your office. You know, they might say, what do you want, lady? Do you want incandescent bulbs? Do you want fluorescent bulbs? Do you want a window? Light is light. It doesn't matter. But that is very wrong. There's a big difference. And people who work in daylighted buildings have much less illness and absenteeism. So we are in a relationship with the light of the sun that's not the same as the way.
So you want to sit by a window?
Yes, you do.
Okay.
So anyway, there's a lot about that, sort of coming to grips with how to design for bodies in nature. And then the last one is the economy, the whole grassroots community-based economics. It's really a lot coming off food security, extrapolating from farmers markets, local farm sources, food security. Gee, maybe it's better for our community to be building up, you know, the exchange of money here instead of sending it out to distant corporate headquarters, buying locally, that kind of thing. But anyway, in the last chapter of Relational Reality, I open it by revisiting what I call, well, it's not what I call, there was the field dependence of women is a phrase that came into the psychological field, and it's still around. I just heard it the other day on NPR. They were talking about teenage girls being field dependent when they figure out how to sell them things. This all came from a study in the early 50s by a researcher named Witkin, and he designed this test of, it was really a field and foreground, and you had to rod, there was a rod you had to try to make exactly vertical, and it was in a surrounding box. So it might have distracted you if you looked at the box instead of the rod, the four figure. So there was a big gender correlation. He had two tests like this of perception, Gestalt perception, or the, you know, if you could just focus on that one piece you were supposed to straighten. And the gender correlation was that most of the young men who took the test, this was all given to college students, were able to do that very well, and most of the young women weren't, because they, he didn't say why, but they were looking at it relationally in a gestalt sense at the total instead of just focusing on the one figure in the foreground. So from that study, he put a positive label on the boys, and he said, ah, they're field independent. They're not dependent on, you know, what's around someone or something. Mm-hmm. But the women, they're field dependent. And from that study, which has been replicated quite a lot, women and children tend to have a gestalt sense of the world. But from that study, other psychological articles were written saying, well, this proves that women are conforming, they're kind of childlike, they're not able to maintain a separate identity, and so they're not very self-reliant. And so I go back and I say, you know, I really think of this as the nadir of that whole patriarchal mechanistic orientation, where they would actually categorize the half of the human species who sees reality in a relational way, and it really is relational,
well,
as being,
well, Charlene,
somehow
isn't that the same thing, like
the
rods and the cones and the eyes?
What?
Isn't that this, sort of the same thing as the rods and the cones and the eyes, that study where men see things more linear and women sort of see the bigger picture all around?
Well, that's my point. With all kinds of tests, we see the gestalt, we see the total, we see the foregrounds, and as I've now, that's in the last chapter, right? So after I've gone through these fields and shown all these crises we're facing are mostly from a lack of relational wisdom, and here are these solutions that are really working because they're based on relational perception, and therefore, if you really want to solve these problems now, on every board or organization, you need at least half women. Not that one sex owns this, not that everybody can't think relationally, but it's been demonstrated that women tend to see the world this way.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, it's time to really get rid of that pejorative label and say, okay, you know, let's bring in the people who have a talent for this.
Yeah, we have to get rid of this survival of this fittest world that we live in. And,
well,
you know, see.
It's the fitting innest, as they say. That was a misinterpretation. I mean, Darwin was aware of how, you know, the ones who fit in with the environment survive.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been living, the human species, in modern cultures with great difficulty in an anti-relational mechanistic system of thought. And that's the way all our institutions and systems of knowledge are figured.
Right.
But
well,
now we're really
it's
on the verge of this big remake, a big redo of this basic way we think about things and see them.
Well, that's hopeful. That sure is hopeful because, you know, you turn on the news and it all seems to be, you know, like we have a very selfish, centered society out there, you know. And it's nice to know that there's this this research out there that, you know, we should be looking out for one another and looking at things more relationally, you know, rather than, you know, dividing up everything.
Yeah, if we could just convince the Boehners of the world, they're going to make themselves sick. But I don't know.
Or maybe more importantly, the Koch brothers, because, you know, they're the ones funding everything.
Well, you know, the real problem is, there's not a functioning opposition party that's saying what should be said. I mean,
Right. True,
I'm speaking as a Green here, but it's very frustrating that I don't hear anyone in Washington saying, oh, we have a budget problem. We need to restore the revenue streams.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have enough money to pay for everything. In the
50s,
we built all those interstate highway systems, even though a lot of that should have been mass transit. But we built all the community college systems. Why? Because the wealthy were paying a higher percentage for their income tax, and the corporations were paying much more for their taxes. And now those two groups have whittled it down to nothing, and they want to pay still less. So, of course, we have a budget deficit in addition to the war. You know, I mean, there's no one saying, let's restore the revenue streams. Of course. You know, we can't pay for things now. Instead, it's all about what do we cut? And I don't hear the Democrats saying, let's restore the revenue streams.
I know. They're really cowardly, and it's frustrating for me, too, because every time I hear, we don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem. And I'm thinking, yeah, you're spending too much money on war, too much money on corporate welfare, you know, too much, you know, giving away too much money to the rich, which, you know, it's insane. And there's no pushback to.
There's no pushback even on the most democratic fairness issue of Social Security. When I saw that Social Security proposal from Paul Ryan the other day, that they privatize it, you know, go out and buy your private, you know, elderly health insurance, and here's a little subsidized coupon you can use, you know, that has nothing to do with the federal budget. Social Security and Medicare are not in the federal budget because they have their own revenue stream. And the reason Social Security doesn't have as much in it as it should is because the rich don't pay their fair share. They pay the same amount we all pay, except when they get up to $106,000, it stops. If they earn $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $4 million, $32 million, they pay no Social Security tax. If they were paying the same 6.5% or 13% that we're all paying, Social Security would be flush.
I know.
It's not. It's a democratic issue of fairness that everybody should be paying. We have a flat fee. We have a flat tax for Social Security. And if everyone were paying it, there would be no budgetary problem with it. But where are the Democrats to say that? Abolish the caps, Paul.
Well, you know what I wonder, and I don't know if you can answer this. I wonder where the churches are in this. You know, I'm not talking about the crazy right wing churches, but the churches who really are the Jesus followers. You know, they're so obviously silent in this redistribution of wealth, and it really just perplexes me because, you know, it's all about, you know, individualism. Well, you know what? It's not a level playing field out there.
They put out statements every once in a while. I mean, I follow the Catholics, you know, more, I suppose, than the others, so I pay attention to these bishops' letters, and they say the right things once in a while and even often on social issues. But the way the system is set up, that has no weight. You know, since we can't get campaign finance reform, everything, every vote is driven by what will please the big donors.
Right.
You know, what will please the corporate donors? What will please the very rich? They don't want the caps abolished on Social Security, so nobody talks about it in Washington.
Right. Well, we're in trouble. You know, we're seriously in trouble. But the good thing is there are solutions out there. I mean,
that's
like
right.
What you're talking about. I mean, there are people who have pieces of the puzzle so that if we did want to reshape our world, we're not lost.
Right. And then more and more is coming to the fore all the time. That's what got me really excited about relational reality.
Well, Charlene, this has really been interesting, and we have 5 minutes left. So I know it's not a lot of time, but what would be one of the most important ideas you'd maybe want to leave listeners with related to our discussion that maybe we haven't had a chance to cover yet?
Well, first, just the fact that the book is not out yet, but it will be out by the end of April. So Relational Reality will be in bookstores and on Amazon in the third or fourth week of April. I guess I would say back to the physiological part. I mean, there's been a lot of attention on what I call relational behavior, how connectivity, as the social scientists call it, being in a social network, if somebody gives up smoking or takes up smoking or loses weight or gains weight, the people in the network around him might do the same thing. So that's gotten a lot of attention. I think it's interesting, but it's not as dramatic as the relational physiology. So one was, let's see, oh dear, I have so many. What can I pick from?
Well, you know, so many people are concerned about cancer. Was there any, you know, anything popped up with cancer? Or it just sort of fits under the general disease category?
Yeah, not as a direct cure, but as ways to keep healthy. There are all kinds of relational things. You know, we need sunlight. We need sociability. I think we also need, women really need a period of solitude as well as the sociability every day, a contemplative time.
That red tent.
What?
That red tent, you know, how we talk about during menses, women
yeah.
used to go to the red tent.
Yeah. Well, even every day. We just can't be frazzled running around. We need, I don't know, the warm bath at night or something. But, you know, there's really too much. But you're going to, my point in writing this book is so people can connect the dots and hear about these things, see it in the paper, hear it on the news, and instead of just turning the paper and saying, oh, turning the page, oh, that was kind of interesting, but it doesn't, I don't know what to make of it. Just see, oh, there it is again. There's another one. Because it's really popping up everywhere. And I hope that this will give people the, you know, the lens to be able to recognize it, because that's what we need. We need to be able to see this is a rising phenomenon, a big challenge, a big correction to the mechanistic way we've been trying to go through life as a modern society. And
right.
if we don't see the connection, it won't go as fast and as far as it could if we really recognize what's happening, what we're living through.
Well, and dare I say, I will probably start quoting your book when I go out there and tell people ideals of the sacred feminine are the way of the future, because everything I heard you say tonight to me felt like, you know, a sacred feminine ideal, you know, the different way of...
Yes, doesn't it?
And little did I know our mottos would fit so well with, you know, with what you said, you know, Gilligan's work and all of that. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's like science is moving in our direction. Science
Finally.
Is showing that the physical world is incredibly interrelated. And that's the way we've always seen it. So yippee.
Right. Right. Well, Charlene, I can't wait for the book to come out. And you know what? If when it is out, if you want to pop me an email, I will announce it to my database and to the listeners so that they are reminded to go look for it. Because, you know, there's so many of us that, you know things have to change, but don't know what to change to. And, you know,
right.
and I think, you know, this gives some, you know, some tools, some guideposts on, you know, how in this paradigm shift we all talk about, what that can look like. And I think
right.
that gives people comfort, you know.
Right. And relational reality shows them that it's really happening. It's not, you know, wishful thinking.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for putting that out. Very important work. And thank you so much for being on the show and sharing that with us. I'll definitely look forward to the book.
Oh, thank you.
Well, good night.
Good night.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking, or the feminine consciousness, as some of us call it, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks will save the world. I am even more convinced now that I've spoken to Charlene about this relational reality. So anyhow, you want to make sure you look for her book, Relational Reality, New Discoveries of Interrelatedness Transforming the Modern World. So I'm going to go ahead and go to my next guest. And Nancy, I'm having a little bit of trouble with my switchboard here. I've never had this happen before. So if by any chance you and I get disconnected, I'm going to have to hang up and call back in. So don't panic. Just hang in there with me, okay? I think it's going to probably be all right, but I just want to give you a heads up. Okay, so are you there with me, Nancy? Nancy? Hi, Nancy. A real weird glitch on the switchboard tonight. I don't know what that was for sure, but I'm so glad you're with me tonight. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let me start off by telling folks a little bit about you, and then we'll jump into our chat about the roles of women in the Frontier West. Listeners, Nancy came to my attention because she's the author of Hawk Moon, a novel about a woman called Sadie Hawk Moon. She's a young girl kidnapped by someone called Ice, a brutal horse thief. Nancy is a 1990 graduate of Allegheny College in Medfield, Pennsylvania, and she's worked as a counselor and grant writer at Women's Services Incorporated. Also, she's been a domestic sexual violence, she's worked at a domestic sexual violence shelter, also in Medville. And Hawk Moon was a finalist for the Colorado Humanities Award in 2010 and the Colorado Book Award. Her second novel, Grace, is going to be released in 2010. And let's see, and she's also won the Paul Gillette Writers Prize at the Pikes Peak Writers Conference in 2009. Now, was that for Hawk Moon, Nancy?
Actually, Grace was the one that won the Paul Gillette Writers Prize, and that was like you said, in 2009. And
okay.
Hawk Moon won the Colorado, was a finalist for the Colorado Book Award in 2010.
Okay. Well, and you know, my listeners are, you know, probably are saying, fiction writer. I usually don't have very many fiction writers on the show. Probably in 3 years I've had five. But I was really interested in talking about your book, but more from the perspective of, I figured you must have had to do a lot of research into the roles of women at that, you know, time period in the Frontier West. And, you know, and that's sort of a gap, I think, in our study and our knowledge. You know, we might, you know, go look into like an indigenous, you know, Native American women or something like that, but I can't recall anybody ever saying, well, what was it like for frontier women? What was their life like? So I thought, you know, you would be the woman to, you know, fill that gap for us.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, it was a very interesting time period. I think that's kind of one of the reasons why we maybe get into this in later questions, but that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book was, you know, I was raised on the formulaic classic Western, you know, the it was always kind of a man story, you know, Clint Eastwood, you know, certainly, which whom I love the man, you know, he holds the market on, you know, on the Western story. And it always just, you know, all those stories seem to be kind of men's stories. So,
yeah,
but, you know, women
cowboy,
are so
you know?
Integral for that whole time period. It's really amazing.
So, all right, so we're talking about the 19th century, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess let's start with, were women oppressed?
Well, they certainly were. I mean, certainly, you know, if you think about, you know, we have come a long way. Really the way that women were viewed at that time period was very much as property. I even hate to say that because it just sounds so ugly, but it's true. You know, they were very much secondary and just really very much second-class citizens. Of course, you know, they didn't have the right to vote, and that goes without saying. But just you know, their opinion was very, pretty much on the back burner, if even considered at all. So I would say across the board, it was kind of a disconnect. I mean, obviously, women were treated as ladies, and there was a certain, chivalry that still kind of managed to make its way through to the frontier. But basically, kind of the attitude was that women had their place, and that was that.
So I guess they were there to pleasure their man, have babies, and make sure there was a meal on the table.
Pretty much so. That was certainly a very Victorian attitude, and I think as the migration went across the frontier, across the plains, those roles were forced to change. But it was very difficult it was by necessity that some of those roles had to change. But even so, even as women took more of the working roles in the frontier, working in the land and that kind of thing, there was still that attitude that, okay, you're going to do this, you're going to have more of a man's role, but we're still going to treat you as a second class person.
Right. Well, I'm wondering, was it different for different classes of women? Like, for instance, we see on television anyway, a woman could be a teacher. So was there a little bit of working outside the home? But I would imagine, it probably was limited to maybe a teacher, huh?
Very few, yeah. I mean, you could either be probably a handful of roles that you could fulfill. You could be a teacher, obviously a mother, housewife, that kind of thing, or a prostitute was another one.
Or
and,
nurse,
you know, just a few,
nurse.
Very few, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
So tell us, did you have the occasion to, sort of delve a little bit into the lives of the prostitutes? We see some things where, there were different categories of prostitute. Of course, unfortunately, sort of the lowly prostitute, but also maybe, the ones that wielded power, like maybe the madam or something. And anything like that cross your research?
Actually, quite a bit. That was a really interesting research point that I came across. I was actually very surprised, again, because of my background, just growing up, seeing kind of the Hollywood version of the prostitute. And it's actually really a huge myth. Women fell into prostitution because basically, if they lost their husband or didn't have one in the first place, they didn't have any other options. They would come to a frontier town. Which had very limited options, very small population compared to, to what we have now. And so all of those good positions like school teacher, laundress or cook or a boarding house person were at a premium. And so if you couldn't get into any of those, then prostitution was your last resort. And in fact, most prostitutes ended up homeless, dying in poverty. A lot of them actually starved to death. I mean, they were disease stricken. They had often died, trying to give themselves abortions. So it was a very, very, very different scenario than I think what we've been, led to believe, with Hollywood.
Right, right. Yeah, they sort of, I think of, well, I might be wrong about this because it's been a long time, but remember Miss Kitty on Gunsmoke? wasn't she a madam? I'm not sure. Was she, or do you remember?
I think she was, and that, again, I think that was a little bit of a subtle. I think that was kind of a myth, yeah. You can't generalize and say that never happened, but I think the typical role for a prostitute was just really a desperate profession.
Right. Well, I had another guest on the show not too long ago. He was talking about I hate to use the word low life. Forgive me. My brain isn't quite as sharp tonight. I'm having this horrible cold. But the people in the lower strata of society. He came on the show and he was talking about the people in the lower strata of society who actually shaped our country. And he was talking about how the madams actually treated their prostitutes better than a lot of people did, and it was actually, believe it or not, the feminists who sort of messed that up for prostitutes because, the feminists wanted to look like they were aligned with the proper folk. So, you know, they sort of put the madams out of business, and so then the prostitutes didn't have the protection of the madam. And I don't know, I'm rambling, but you know, this is just sort of bringing that all back for me again, you know.
That's interesting because, the research that I've done on that kind of might dispute that a little bit, that maybe that's more of the, and again, maybe, the, you know, like in the later part of the frontier, maybe in the, you know, closer to the, like the, you know, the late 1800s, maybe, you know, that came into play more, but certainly like in the, you know, the mid, you know, like in the 1860s, 1870s, I think it was pretty sketchy.
Okay. Well, and I don't know if this is something you ran across, but I'm really curious if you know what kind of birth control they used. Did that happen to be something you researched?
Actually, you know, that's a very interesting question. There's very little documentation about that, and I, even in the writing of my own book, I kind of came across, actually I was asked just that very same question about the main character in my book, Sadie Hawkmoon, where, you know, she was systematically sexually abused for years, and someone said, well, why didn't she get pregnant? And I think in her case, certainly, I could probably take a little writer's license and say, well, you know, I just didn't want her to get pregnant, so I didn't make her get pregnant. But that's a really great, you know, that is a great question. I think that a lot of times they did, but also because of those, you know, those dire living circumstances they were living under, the conditions that they were living at, that the poverty and the lack of physical condition, you know, I think when you're in poor health, it is more difficult to become pregnant, and so that kind of gives a basis for that argument that they weren't in such good health, you know, that they couldn't become pregnant because they were very ill, you know, in very poor condition.
Right. Well, now, so the West, did the West shape women? I mean, did women benefit from this, you know, this westward expansion?
You know, they probably didn't think they did. Again, you know, we were coming from a very, you know, Eastern, you know, kind of Victorian way of life with starched aprons and, you know, bustles and, you know, just the long skirts and just, you know, very, you know, nicely, pretty decent, you know, household, well-kept houses, suddenly launched into life on the frontier, which, you know, the plains are an incredibly difficult environment to live in. And, you know, if you've never lived there, and you imagine, you know, picking up everything, your piano, your fine china, and your way of life, which is very pretty good, and then going into this vast expanse of nothingness where, you know, disease and, you know, all kinds of things await you, and to be able to be forced to adapt to that, I think was an amazing thing that women and, you know, everybody did, but women in particular, you know, having to being the homemakers of the time period, being forced to keep a house, you know, their children and their family and just everything, the laundry and the cooking and everything in this basically, you know, in like a backpacking kind of atmosphere in a wagon is really, really extraordinary. And
yeah,
so
I mean,
they really had to kind of pony up, you know, to be able to do that well.
Well, you know, we don't think about it, but just imagine riding in that rickety wagon for hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of miles. I can't even imagine how horrible. And then, you know, they get somewhere and, you know, they have to, if they're not going to a town, they have to build a house. Our lives are so easy. You know, I think that would kill us.
Yeah, it would. I mean, actually, you know, a lot of those houses were sod houses, so they were dug into the ground, you know. So imagine living in a house where it's not even made out of wood. I mean, you're basically living in a glorified hole in the ground where the dirt is constantly sifting down into everything you do. There's actually a great book. It's a story of the, you know, the westward expansion via women's diaries. So it's like the Oregon Trail, and it's all these diaries that were kept by women. And the most poignant part of that book is just the as they're going along the trail, it's just basically a trail of graves because people were dying of smallpox and various things. And the women were very, very interested or just made notes constantly of how many graves they passed every day. It was a woman thing to do that. It wasn't so much a man thing. They weren't so much concerned with that. But if you look at the journals that the men kept, they didn't pay so much attention to that. But the women were, you know, we passed 20 graves today, 30 graves today, and, you know, some were fresh, and just the conditions of the graves. And it really, you know, so imagine passing that every day and all these people that have died. And there you are, like, wondering, you know, is it going to be me, you know, next? It just was incredible.
Well, you know, and I'm thinking, too, and I might be wrong about this, feel free to correct me because, you know, I like to get things right when I can. It would seem like life might have been disproportionately harder on women because, I mean, look, they had to deal with their menses. They had to deal with pregnancy. They were the ones that had to get up in the morning and cook the three meals and keep, you know, mend the clothes and wash the clothes. I mean, what did the men have to do except get their gun and go out and shoot something for dinner? I might have it wrong, but it seems like the women had a lot more work.
I think so. You're absolutely. I mean, that's the way, certainly the way I see it. And actually, you know, just the sense of propriety, you know, that women had to maintain. I mean, you talk about, you know, yeah, having your, you know, your period out, you know, on the frontier. I mean, and having to just go to the bathroom with a, you know, sense of decorum and just the discretion that accompanies almost virtually everything that you do. I find it to be a monumental effort. It just gives me a headache just thinking about it. It's incredible.
But you think, though, that, I mean, this was a positive thing for women? I mean, do you think it sort of, you know, I don't know, toughened them up or, you know, were they better for the experience, you think?
Definitely. I think in the long run, again, like if you were to, you know, well, actually, no, I can even remember, I'm thinking, you know, calling to mind several, again, of those diary entries where if you ask them, do they think that they were better off? I mean, I bet you'd get some interesting answers. But historically speaking, yes, I think there's no question about it that it was kind of a trial by fire or, growing pains, you know, something that the gender has benefited tremendously from to go through that migration, that whole shift. It's a total paradigm shift. So I think so, yes, definitely.
Did you run across anything on midwives by any chance?
Not so much in my research. I mean, you know, because it didn't really come to play in the books that I've been writing, but I mean, definitely, I think, you know, most women became, you know, midwives just by necessity. You know, again, if, you know, someone was having a baby, then everybody just kind of chips in. Actually, you know, there is one scene in my book where one has a baby and the child, they both, she and the baby end up dying in childbirth. But, you know, it's kind of by proxy, you know, everybody kind of, well, there's nobody else, so
yeah,
just, you know, chip in. And that's kind of the way it worked as far as I could tell back then.
Right. Well, now, so what does Hollywood get right and what do they get wrong?
Well, I think, you know, certainly any stereotype is not without basis in reality. I mean, I think, you know, there's always some elements of truth to things. So I wouldn't want to say that every character, you know, female character in Hollywood is wrong or anything. But I think the thing that I object the most to is that there are so few, you know, women's stories in those Westerns. You know, there are so many stories that are fascinating and amazing, you know, the adaptability of women and their strength and just their perspective on the West, I think, is a completely untold story. And so that's kind of I think that's what's missing. I think, you know, women are portrayed as in a very one-dimensional way. And so, you know, I think, yeah, you know, I mean, you know, it's, they're pretty, you know, it's not that it's so much so inaccurate, but it's just not all, it's not the whole story.
I think you're saying their characters really aren't developed.
Definitely, yeah.
You know, well, were there women that broke the mold, you know, that, I mean, are we talking like the Annie Oakleys or anybody like that? Or?
Yeah, definitely. You know, those were very, she was a very real character. In fact, in my third novel, that's actually, this whole thing is a trilogy, so the third novel, she actually comes into, she actually makes an appearance in that novel. She's a great character. And Calamity Jane, you know, was a real character. We kind of think of these ones like, oh, did they really exist? I mean, there was really a chick back then that, you know, gun toting and all that kind of stuff. And it's actually, you know, very, very true. And if you look at the history, you read the stories of you know, who they were, they're really fascinating. One thing that I would love to maybe even myself write a story about that I didn't even know had happened until I started researching for these books were there was about 150 documented cases of women who dressed up like men and fought side by side in the Civil War with men. And they think there's probably actually about 400 women that did that.
And why did they do that?
Well, they wanted to be a part of it, and they didn't want to sit at home, and it's really an amazing story. I mean, a lot of these women, nobody even knew that this had happened until some of the cases were like, you know, diaries were found in attics, and they didn't know that great-grandma, you know, did this, and it's like, holy smokes.
Wow. Well,
yeah, it's really a fascinating story.
Well, you know, you're saying that, and I'm just remembering that we talked about on the show some time back about women in Afghanistan. Some of them are actually choosing to pretend to be men as well, because life is so limited for women. They try to pass themselves off as men.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of them are living that way.
Right, and isn't that amazing? I mean, I think it'll how history just is, that just seems to perpetuate our, you know, our society all globally, that there's a need for that.
Well, and it also speaks to the unfortunate state of women, you know, around the world, that in some places, you know, how horrendous it still is that a woman would have to resort to something like that.
Right, I don't know if there's going to be any end in sight anytime soon, again, you know, in some parts of the world for that.
Well, now, did you run into the, you know, I mean, I naturally assume that what kept women down in the 19th century is what keeps women down today, still religion. Was that, you know, a part of, you know, the life of your characters at all in the book?
I think, actually, it's interesting you say that, because in this book, Hawk Moon, not so much, but in the next book, the second in the trilogy is called Grace. And their religion plays a huge part in that book, and just, you know, its repression, you know, of not only just women, but I think of, you know, of people in general, and just it's, you know, maybe that's a whole other argument that we don't get into, but, you know, just a kind of a manipulation that can happen with, I think, with religion in the wrong hands, I'll put it that way, you know, and that's
sure,
kind of what, what the next book is about.
Yeah, it's just like a gun, you know,
exactly.
In the wrong hands. So Hawk Moon is the first one in the trilogy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Grace is the second?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And you're working on the third one now?
Yep, the third one. I actually just finished the first draft of the third one, and that's called Blood Truth, and that will actually tie the first two books together.
So is it a thread of, you know, a matriarchal line or something like that of women that go from one book to another?
Well, that's, I don't know if I want to give that away, but definitely they, you know, the characters are very connected, and, you know, just certainly I think they're really connected by their, you know, like a very violent past, and the kind of the common thread of all of the books is not to be, you know, not to allow yourself to be defined by something that's happened to you in your past. You know, if something terrible has happened to you, that doesn't have to be your story. You know, you can make a choice to overcome that or go beyond what you think, you know, you might have been for a long time. It doesn't have to be your whole story.
Well, what do you think listeners would want to hear about the women in your book? You know, talk a little bit about, you know, the female characters in Hawk Moon.
Well, Sadie Hawk Moon is the main character, and you know, she's a tough girl. Yeah, you know, I think she kind of defies those classic roles. That's kind of one of the things that I wanted to do is tell a Western story in a woman's perspective, but to really kind of shift that whole role of the, you know, the classic guy, you know, with the carrying the gun, and put a woman in that role and just see what would happen. And they're all the women really are very strong characters, and they don't take any guff. That's kind of the, you know, what I wanted to be very empowering, and just to show that, you know, you don't have to feel like you're, you know, being possessed by someone else. You know, that independence of character and of freedom of characters is really what I was trying to bring across.
Well, and not that this is a judgment, because it's not. I'm just trying to get inside your, you know, the writer's head.
Sure.
Because I've never written fiction. I've only written nonfiction. But did you write them empowered? Because I'm assuming from what we've said up to this point, women weren't very empowered. So did you sort of write them in a way that wasn't in keeping with, at the accuracy of the time?
I did. I mean, that was kind of the whole, it was more of an in-your-face, again, twist of the old formula. You know, I really wanted to, instead of doing something a little more subtle of like, oh, here's this strong woman who's kind of, you know, she's in the kitchen and doing her thing. It's like, well, what if, let's like really throw it out there and tap into those Annie Oakley and, you know, Calamity Jane and, you know, pant-wearing, gun-toting kind of characters, and let's put a woman there and see what happens, and will people buy that, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so far they have, which is good news, you know, and just kind of see what happens. So yeah, I mean, in a way, you know, the strength I think is accurate, but you know, it's a strength that we don't often see in Westerns, just because again, it's those secondary characters that are kind of put in the background. It's, you know, that the stuff that we've seen so far I think has been a very kind of quiet, understated strength, where this is more, hey, you know, I mean, it's out there, and just I wanted to see what would happen.
Well, and I'm just curious, you know, because speaking about like Annie Oakley or Calamity Jane, you must have researched their lives. I'm just curious, do you think they were lesbian women, or do you think they were heterosexual? I mean, did they marry, or?
They did marry, you know? Yeah. There's not any evidence that I could, because that was certainly one of my questions too. I just kind of wanted to, you know, see if there was anything written about that. There certainly was nothing written about that. Annie Oakley did in fact marry. Calamity Jane had several beaus, and Belle Starr actually was also married. She was another good character, woman in the Old West. But they all were definitely involved in heterosexual relationships. But so that, you know, and that's another interesting element that also I wanted to bring into Sadie Hawkmoon, was that, you know, that element of like, can you be tough and also, you know, love and want to be loved at the same time. So it's not like an either or, like, okay, I have to be this tough chick and I can't love a man or love anybody. But you know, so there's that human quality that wanted to bring to her also.
Well, what about the character we see in True Grit, Mattie Ross? What do you think about her? Do you think that was a realistic portrayal?
Well, again, you know, I think yes and no. I mean, I'm never one to generalize. I hate to do that. So I'm sure that there were, you know, the Mattie Rosses, just like, again, you know, there were the Annie Oakleys and that kind of thing. But typically, you know, I think she would have probably been seen as a pretty, like, wow, that's one brazen little girl there, you know. So she was obviously tough talking about. I love the character so much because, again, that's exactly what I want to see out there is more of those, you know, just, you know, central female characters that are bold and brassy and able to ride with the guys. And I think that's it feels very contemporary to me. You know, it's amazing that, you know, True Grit is a pretty old novel. And so for that concept to be that old, I think is fantastic. And then, of course, to be, you know, for the Coen brothers to bring it to the screen again was great.
Well, and, you know, and I can't help but think about the TV show Little House on the Prairie.
One of my faves.
do you think that was a little bit maybe more accurate for the time?
I think, you know, in a lot of ways, yes. I mean, I think, you know, for a certain, again, for that kind of like little frontier family. I do love that show. I mean, I just watched it tonight. In fact, they have it, like 5 times a day. It was part of my childhood. I, definitely grew up on it. But, I think it certainly is accurate, to a certain extent. Again, I think they did a pretty good job of actually being a little more three-dimensional than a lot of other shows that we've seen.
Okay. In terms of women taking on, men's roles in Westerns and movies, do you think that's important?
I think so, just in the sense, again, like what we're talking about, bring a different context to that time period and to acknowledge that there were women like that out there. They weren't just the Mrs. Ingalls, waiting by the stove, and all that stuff, even though that maybe, certainly is accurate. But I think we need to see these really, these more prominent, central women characters that are tough and kind of taking center stage just to kind of round it out a little bit and present a little bit of a different picture to the time period. And then again, it feels more contemporary to me. I think it enlivens the Western, kind of brings it home to our, our time period, modern viewers to make it more accessible and for women to be able to relate to something like that. You can see, Hollywood Ray is doing it in a lot of other aspects now. There's lots of movies out there where there's tough female characters. Angelina Jolie has done, amazing things for being
what you're saying. even though the accuracy of the time maybe suffers, save that for the documentary. But for the sake of empowering women to see themselves in, roles that sort of stretch the parameters of the box. I think TV and Hollywood have done wonderful things that not only show women that they can go beyond, what maybe patriarchal society has told them they can do and be, but it also makes men understand that, women are not, this pawn of patriarchy. I think about Seven of Nine and, you just said a minute ago, my brain lost it. But, all of these wonderful female, you said, well, Angelina Jolie. Tomb Raider.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of, powerful female characters that, show women capable, empowered, in control, and, rather than subservient,
mm-hmm.
subservient and oppressed and, under the thumb of a guy,
Right, and definitely, there have been pulling Mrs. Ingalls, Carolyn Ingalls back into the fray. She was a strong woman, but again, it's kind of in a packaged sort of way, in a box sort of way that we can have that's what women should be, she's strong, but she's still, by God, she better have dinner on the table by, 5 o'clock when Paul comes in from the fields, or else I don't know what's going to happen, but what if she didn't?
Right.
What's going to happen then, And so it's kind of stepping out of that box a little bit just to, like you said, kind of stretch it a little bit and just to see what else would happen. And, again, it's not without historical basis because we do have the Annie Oakleys and the Calamity Janes and there's actually quite a laundry list of tough women, that are historically accurate that, you could make many, many movies that are very historically accurate, probably 20 movies based on actual women in, the 19th century that were kind of definitely not what we've seen before.
Well, you mentioned your publicist sent me a name I hadn't heard before, Sally Skull.
Yeah.
we have the time. Why don't you talk a little bit about, who these women were and if you know, what do you think made them take a different path? Was it they were just rebels from the start or was it out of necessity or what can you tell us?
I think, a lot of them were probably rebels from the start. I think environment plays a tremendous part in like how we are shaped. And again, that's a huge theme in all of these books is just, you know, kind of nature versus nurture and how, you know, how our environment really makes us and shapes us and that kind of thing. So I think, you know, that a lot of these women were definitely just brought up in rough times and that kind of thing. But actually, it's interesting. Lonesome Dove is a favorite book of mine by Larry McMurtry, and he talks about Sally Skull, but she was this kind of slatternly prostitute, and you know, in that book, and it's very different. You know, she really wasn't quite the accurate thing, but you know, she was pretty tough and pretty unsavory, and I think she killed a couple of people, and so you know, she wasn't like a heroine, I would say, by any means, but I think definitely, you know, they were. I would say that most of these women were brought up, you know, were raised in an environment that they didn't just kind of like, you know, come out of a well-to-do family and just decide to be crazy. You know, I think they were kind of raised in they were kind of formed by their kind of a rough environment.
Well, now, was it Calamity Jane and Annie Oakley, one of them or either of them? Weren't they the ones in the Buffalo Bill show or something?
Yes, Annie Oakley was. She was actually an amazing, all the sharpshooter stories about her were true. She actually started her kind of career as a sharpshooter just because, again, like you said, out of necessity. Her family was very poor, and she gained her accuracy just by shooting game around the house to feed the family when she was a little girl, and married, you know, I guess she, you know, became, was kind of discovered, you know, along the way by a gentleman who later became her husband, but she could, I mean, she was amazing, the shots that she could do, and I guess, you know, she practiced, but basically that's how she got her start, was just shooting varmints for the stew pot.
Well, you know, I've actually heard women are better shots than men, but you know, I actually at a firing range, I was actually taking shooting lessons, and that was what the guy was telling us, that statistically women are better shots. But well, you know, I guess did either Annie Oakley or Calamity Jane or Sally Skull, I mean, were they mothers? I mean, did they have children?
Annie Oakley did. I'm not sure about Sally Skull. I think Calamity Jane did. I know that Belle Starr actually, I think, is believed to have been murdered by her own son. So yes, they. I think pretty much all of them had children.
Okay. Well, now this might sound like a strange question, but I think maybe there's a surprise answer. Do you think women are better off now than they were back then?
I think wholesale, yes. I think, you know, certainly we've come a long way. You know, obviously, you know, we can get into the voting thing. Yes, we can vote. I mean, I think we've definitely made a lot of progress. Interestingly enough, though, in my work for a sexual assault center, I think I did some articles on that element of how far we've come in terms of, you know, are rape statistics any better than they were then, or the attitudes around sexual assault any different than they were way back then? And I would say that we're pretty close to being about the same. Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of stigma and stereotypes attached to, you know, why is a woman assaulted, and you know, the victim blaming and that kind of thing. And so I think that's element of it. I think we're pretty much back in the dark ages, but you know, yeah, I mean, I think overall, we're better off than we were back then. If you really do the research, yeah, I mean, I've always romanticized the West myself, and you know, that's part of the reason why I wrote these books, was to kind of demystify it even for myself. And so if you read these, you know, letters of women going across the Overland Trail, it's like, boy, I don't think I'd want to do that.
There were any aspects of their life that maybe is better than, you know, contemporary woman's life?
Well, I think, you know, the freedom certainly, you know, that's going to come out wrong, but, you know, I think there were certain kind of a free spiritedness, I think, that accompanied, you know, back then, that maybe seems a little, I think we, you know, it's just different. I mean, the, you know, the whole idea of discovering new country and everything, I think, was, you know, had a lot of attenuating kind of, you know, a freedom aspect to it that maybe we just don't have quite the same way now. But again, you know, I do feel that overall that we've certainly come along. We have a long way to go yet, and there's lots of things that aren't perfect. But comparatively speaking, you know, I think it's a no-brainer.
Okay. Well, Nancy, you know, before I let you go, is there, you know, anything you want to tell us about your book that maybe I haven't thought to ask you, or about the Women of the West?
I think we've done a really good job. The questions have been great, but definitely, you know, it's. I think again, it's you know, just a story that it's just a woman's story, and I think even a lot of men that have read it have found it very, very enlightening and entertaining, and it really is just a different take on that time period, and I think it would. You know, I think it would just surprise a lot of people if they were to read it, and maybe spark a lot of interest in the time period, and just, you know, just different, you know, different issues that we all might come across, not even just women, but relationship issues and that kind of thing that are always very important, you know, in terms of our growth, and, you know, where we're going to go next.
Yeah, I mean, because I guess what you're saying is it doesn't matter where you are or what the time period. There's some things that go on in life that are just going to happen, you know, that you have to learn to deal with and to grow and it's just part of life, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, you know, I think the whole frontier to me is, you know, is about discovery, and so to kind of use that as a backdrop for self-discovery was, I thought, a something that I wanted to do and felt really beautiful.
Well, it's a fresh idea. Okay, so listeners, just as a reminder, if we've piqued your curiosity with this, the first book is Hawk Moon, the novel about Sadie Hawk Moon, and then the second of the trilogy is Grace.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy's website is nlwbooks.com, nlwbooks.com. Well, Nancy, thank you so much, you know, for coming on the show and talking to us and, you know, helping us understand a little bit more what it was like for women at that time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a very great pleasure talking to you.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and good night, and let us know when the next book's out.
I sure will. Have a good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in to my two guests tonight, and I still have a few things to share with you if you want to stay tuned in with me. I wanted to let you know that next week my guests are going to be Barbara Walker. I'm sure many of you know that name. We're going to be talking about Barbara's newest book that's out, and let's see if I can remember the title. I think it is called Man Made God, and she's returning to the show. Barbara has been interviewed here once or twice before, and it's always great to have her back. And following Barbara next week, we're going to have Patrick McCullum back. Now, Patrick, he is another favorite of ours. He has just been out there setting the world on fire as a pagan. He is going to bring us up to date on all the things that have been happening. If you recognize his name, you know that he won the Mahatma Gandhi Award, and he's the one that has the court case still pending in California about the Tier 1 versus Tier 2 religions. You know, it's about religious discrimination. He's going to bring us up to date on that. And he's sort of hinted at there's a lot of positive stuff going on out there in the world. And we definitely, we want to hear about the positive stuff, for sure. You know, we want to hear about the stuff that's going to give us hope. Then the following week, on April 20th, we're going to have Stephen Jones on the show. He is the documentary maker of the film on Olivia, Priestess of Isis. That's Olivia Robertson, one of the foundresses of the Fellowship of Isis. And after I interview him on the 20th, we're going to have Greek scholar Nano Marinatos on the show. And she has some interesting takes on Minoan goddesses and life there in Crete. We're going to be talking about her research and her book by the title of Minoan Kingship and the Solar Goddess. Can't wait for that. I think maybe, you know, compared to feminist theology, some controversial stuff. So you'll want to tune in and see what she says, maybe versus what most of us have been taught. Then the last week, we're going to have Marie Jones on the show. She's written a book called The Trinity Secret. And if we're lucky, if we can get her, we're going to have Yaba Badeau on the show. She is also a documentary maker, and she made the documentary The Witches of Gamba, The Witches of Gamba. And I think she's going to be in the country. She's attending the New York African Film Festival. And some of you may have heard about that film, Witches of Gamba, that talks about the women in Africa who have been called witches and what their life has been like and the oppression that they've suffered. So anyway, you'll want to, you know, make sure you tune in every week, and you'll be sure not to forget if you hit that follow button on my show page. Now, also, I usually don't have time to talk about this, so if you'll indulge me for a moment, if you're new to the show, then you might not know I've written two books. So please, if you don't mind, let me tell you about those two very quickly. The first one is Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. The second is Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirth Goddess on Planet Earth. Well, the first one, it tells you how to get to these sacred places around the globe if you're a traveler, but maybe more important if you're more the armchair tourist. Many of the reviewers who have read the book tell me that the book has been outstanding for them to make them feel that the book actually takes them there. It's sold everywhere, even in museum bookstores. And my second book, Walking an Ancient Path, well, it actually won a place as a finalist in the spirituality category of the National Best Books Awards. I sort of think of it as a spiritual, socio-political look at embracing goddess, whether that be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how the sacred feminine fits into your life and community. Now, that one sold everywhere as well, but you can get both books from me via my website at a special price of $25 plus shipping and handling, and of course I'll sign them for you. And I also offer a lot of free stuff on my website. Free stuff. We all like free stuff. There are downloadable meditations there, and since we're in spring, you want to check out some of the meditations there that you can download. One of them takes you on a journey to an Isis temple. Another one, it has all the pagan dying and rising gods sitting at the knee of goddess. And in the end of the meditation, those faces morph from one god's face into another god's face. And I'm not going to give away who you see at the very end. You'll have to download the meditation and see for yourself. I have some great articles on my website. Just recently, one of my articles was carried in the international magazine called La Luz International, and the article was titled "The Inhumanity of the GOP: Always for Profits, Not People." So I think that probably brings us up to date. Please remember our tour to Turkey. Oh, and go to my YouTube channel. Almost forgot to tell you that. There's lots of good stuff there. The most recent thing I have posted is a talk that I just gave at the American Academy of Religion. And you can also find some other talks that I've given at other events. There's also the Isis Temple of Thanksgiving you might want to check out, as well as Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary and a lecture on Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. So I think we're about ready to come to a close. Excuse my cough. So let's close with tonight's evening prayer. I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath and sort of bring yourself into a deeper focus. And put yourself in that mind and body space where you go when you want to connect with the mother, connect with your divine source. you know, shift your consciousness. Let a renaissance of Earth Goddess religion lead us to a new age of enlightenment. May love and wisdom guide us in building a multicultural civilization based on respect and cooperation instead of greed and predation. Let the rebirth of a Mother Goddess world culture be the new world order. The peace of Goddess is now expressing in me. Divinely guided, I move with confidence and compassion. I claim my innate health, wholeness, and beauty, and I acknowledge the sacredness of my body. I live in an abundant universe where there is enough for everyone. I seek peace. I speak peace. I live from a peaceful heart. Blessed be. Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in tonight. Thank you for being patient with my horrible head cold here. And I am going to close the evening with something that I don't always get a chance to play for you because we have a little bit more time than usual. I am going to let you hear. Hang on, let me get to it here. I'm going to let you hear from Lane Redman, her piece called Invoking Aphrodite. So enjoy, listeners, and please come back to me next Wednesday and hear Barbara Walker and Patrick McCullum. Good night and have a really good week.
Smoking with incense. Cold water sings through the fruited trees. Everything is shaded under the bower of roses. And from the shimmering radiance of leaves, an enchanted sleep drops down. Here is a meadow of spring flowers where horses graze, and a soft wind gently breathes. Aphrodite, pour your nectar into our golden cup. In grace, make the libation. Bring your Melissa to life.
Oh, boy.